I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. High-profile celebrities make headlines when accusations of domestic violence emerge. Meantime, the number of homicides connected to domestic violence in Johnson County has reached a 20-year high, and there's only one shelter for victims in the entire county. Today, a look at the rising number of domestic violence cases in Kansas, and we talk with a representative from Johnson County's only shelter to learn what resources are available to victims. Then, did you know you age faster on the top floor of a building than the ground floor? We'll talk with a former radio astronomer who uses weird facts like that to get more people interested in science. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In Kansas, domestic violence is back in the news, and the trends aren't good. The number of homicides connected to domestic violence doubled between 2016 and 2017. And in Johnson County alone, the number of cases reached a 20-year high. And yet, there's only one shelter for victims anywhere in the county. In Wyandotte County, by the way, the numbers of incidents dropped from 2016 to 2017, but the number of arrests jumped by 200 to 734. In Missouri, the number of people receiving services for domestic violence is also on the rise. Now a look at the state of domestic violence in Johnson County. What are the resources and what is the need? With us here to talk about it, Desiree Long is Director of Grants, Quality Assurance, and Housing for Safe Home. That's an Overland Park-based organization that works to break the cycle of domestic violence. Desiree, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Megan Austins. She's a senior Johnson County Assistant District Attorney in the Domestic Violence Unit. Megan, thanks for taking time with us today.
Thanks for having us.
You know, this idea, Desiree, that domestic violence is becoming more deadly across the state, what's going on there? What's behind that?
I wish I knew.
Yes, sure.
I think that there is a growing culture and acceptance for violence and hate, and I do think that violence on the whole is growing a little bit. I wish I had exact numbers. I don't, but I do notice that we are seeing more people, and violence is definitely a problem.
Megan, do you have any theories in the prosecutor's office there?
I think that's a really long topic to talk about in a short segment. I will say that looking at the KBI numbers for the homicide statistics from 2017, which showed the doubling amount that you're talking about,
right,
those statistics reflect a definition of domestic violence in Kansas that can be overly broad at times and can include things like parents living at home with kids, adult children, siblings, roommates, and things like that. It doesn't necessarily encapsulate intimate partner and former intimate partner homicides. That number, I actually did a deep dive into those statistics. That number was actually 22 rather than 38 in Kansas. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's unacceptable that this is happening anywhere. These are preventable, and with proper law enforcement training and proper education of the community, we can start really combating it.
But we're seeing concerns about growing violence in connection with domestic violence. We're seeing this across the country, though, aren't we? Because Kansas City, Missouri has been talking about this for years.
Yes, we are. We're seeing it all over the place as far as the numbers. This is a worldwide problem, frankly.
Yeah. There's also this idea that domestic violence is increasing, even if it doesn't lead to murder. Again, I'm asking the impossible question, Desiree. Why is that?
I wish I knew. I do know that that there is a link between unemployment and domestic violence, that when the abusive partner is unemployed, the incidence of it becoming deadly goes up 7 times. There's a link between
which doesn't make any sense because unemployment's so low right now.
And that's
true. Counterintuitive.
Yeah. And that is true. There's also a link, though, between having a gun in the home and domestic violence becoming deadly. That goes up 4 or 5 times. The risk of death for the intimate partner that's being abused goes up 4 or 5 times when there's a gun. So I just think that, and you're right, that unemployment is down. However, I think that that also might play into part of this, which is that when an abusive partner becomes unemployed, sometimes there could be more of a loss of control when they see everybody else being successful and they're unemployed. That can cause that can cause a loss of control or a feeling of loss of control, which is really what domestic violence is about.
You know, Megan, when Desiree was talking about using the word guns, you were nodding your head pretty vigorously. You see that connection too?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you look at the KBI numbers, and it's all publicly available information, the vast majority of those victims who were murdered in 2017 were murdered by gunshots. Gunshots are the number one cause of death, and strangulation is the second one for intimate partner homicides.
You know, you read all the time, Desiree, about victims of domestic violence turned away from shelters because there was just simply no room. I'm wondering, how common is that problem here in the Kansas City area?
It's growing. I can tell you that at my agency in 2018, we turned away 2,500 people.
2,500 people. That includes kids, I assume, not just
correct,
intimate
yes.
partners here.
Yeah. Well, so intimate partners with their children. It's 2,500 people. And that's up for us, 29%. And year after year, it just continues to grow. We work very closely with the other agencies in the metro area to try and find space for those people that we turn away. But sometimes it's hard, and sometimes they have to end up going far away to find somewhere safe.
You know, I don't want to glide by this, what you just said, too quickly here. So what you're saying is that all hell can be breaking out in a home, domestic violence occurring, mom and the kids take off, get in the car, and they go away. They want to get away from the home and spend the night somewhere. And you're saying that in some cases, they can't find any place to stay.
Right. Well, and the good news is that, again, we do have such strong connections with our partners in the Kansas City area. We also have a program called the Lethality Program. And what that program does is if there is indication that there is serious imminent harm, then we can take those people in and even put them on a couch, do anything we can to keep them safe until we can find a better long-term solution.
But do we have situations where a mom is trying to flee and she's thinking in the back of her head, you know, should I not flee because there may not be a place for me to stay? Is that word out in the community that there may not be a place for this person to go?
Yeah, a lot of our survivors really think hard about leaving. Leaving is the most dangerous time. That is when the violence can turn deadly most often. And so they're very worried about leaving. They're worried about coming to a place like Safe Home. You know, we have a wonderful program and a wonderful facility, but it's still scary. It's new to them. And so it's a very difficult decision for people.
It's kind of an amazing thing, Megan, that in this day and age, in a county with so much abundance, that a mom and kids could possibly find themselves without a place to stay in a situation as difficult as this one is.
Well, and it's particularly terrible because a lot of the times the victims and survivors, they won't even try to go to shelter because their abuser has told them that shelter is a terrible place, that it's like a homeless shelter, that it's cots on the floor, things like that. So they've already been sort of programmed, if you will, to not want to go to someplace like that. Also, they can't take their pets there. And that's a huge barrier because what if your abuser has told you that he's going to kill your dog or your cat or whatever if you leave? So you have to make a decision that is incredibly difficult for a lot of people, and you have to leave everything that you know. And oftentimes they don't have access to bank accounts or cars or a way to get there. So there's things that we're trying to do in Johnson County to make that easier and to reduce barriers to safety, but we're not quite there yet. But there's a lot of stuff that we're excited to work on.
So where do these people go in these cases where they can't find somewhere else? I don't want to emphasize this too much because you're saying you guys work hard to find a place, but it sounds like in some cases it doesn't always work out.
Yeah, I mean, and they might stay with a parent or a friend for a few days. Unfortunately, sometimes it is more difficult. And again, we will take people that are in imminent danger. If I can just touch real briefly on the pet issue, this is a very serious issue. We actually ask some of our callers, we ask all of our callers if they need assistance with a pet. We do have a program, a partnership with a local area animal hospital. I won't say which one, but they will take our clients that have pets, they'll take those pets and board them. So that way that kind of reduces that barrier. I mean, we will do anything we can to make sure that there's no barrier for them coming.
You know, I'm going to plead guilty to being a meathead here, Megan. So I never thought about the pet aspect of this, but hearing Desiree talk about it, I can quickly see that can be a pretty big deal.
Well, it's a really big deal. And there's a lot of things that people who aren't in abusive relationships or who don't work with survivors wouldn't even think about, like not having access to a car or a bank account or things like that. There's just a lot of considerations that people who have healthy relationships wouldn't even think of that we deal with, unfortunately, every day. The reality of, you know, people living in their own homes in fear all the time. And I've had cases where the victim was kept inside her apartment for 3 months with audible alarms installed on the doors, essentially held captive. And that stuff goes on all the time, even here in Johnson County, where people necessarily wouldn't think that it does.
How do you guys navigate this world emotionally for yourselves? I mean, this is tough stuff, and you're immersed in it, Megan, every single day, from what I can tell.
Well, it helps that we all have – that we work closely together and we can talk about these sorts of things together in-house. Yeah. And they're difficult cases to deal with. But frankly, some of the best way to deal with it is in the courtroom. You know, if you get to put a stake in a monster and put them out so they don't get to hurt anybody else again, that's immensely satisfying.
How many times a year does that happen for you in Johnson County that you think you've just done that by putting a stake in a monster?
Well, it depends. We don't get monsters every single day. But when you put somebody in prison for what amounts to the rest of their life, that happens a couple times a year, probably.
Yeah. How do you deal with it?
It's hard. Yeah. It's an emotionally taxing job. But we as an agency at Safe Home, we know that. And we do everything we can to promote what we call self-care. There's a thing called trauma stewardship and sort of secondary trauma, and a lot of our staff deal with that, hearing those things day in and day out. So we do have self-care plans with our staff, and we just do the best we can to try and really promote positivity and do good things.
We're talking about domestic violence in Johnson County this morning on Up to Date, and if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, Desiree, I'm just struck by the fact that Safe Home bills itself as the only shelter for domestic violence in Johnson County. How can that be?
Well, and we've had a long road. We've been an agency since 1980. We were founded by Martha Hunt, and she started it in her home and mm-hmm. in neighbors' homes. And it took a long time to grow to the agency to what it is today. And all of our services are free of charge. So it really depends on community support. And so if we don't have community support, we have wonderful community support. But in order to grow and in order to maybe have more opportunities for other agencies, we're going to need more community support. So, yeah.
That goes without saying, Megan, we need more.
We absolutely do. And I'm excited to announce that we've started the Johnson County Family Justice Center Foundation just recently. It's a nonprofit. And our goal is to raise enough money to open up a Family Justice Center in Johnson County, which will be a one-stop shop for victims of crime so that they can come to one place to get all the services that they need. Counseling, they can get a forensic exam there if they need it, interviewed by a detective if they need it. Their children can be cared for in a trauma-informed daycare while they go to court. It reduces a lot of the barriers and a lot of the different places that victims have to go to. This is a model that's been set up around the country, and there's about 170 of them, I believe, worldwide. So we aim to start one here in Johnson County. So we've just started with our fundraising efforts. We're partners with Safe Home. We're partners with Sunflower House, with the heads of all major law enforcement agencies, including Olathe, Overland Park, and Johnson County Sheriff's Office. And Steve Howe, the district attorney, is on our board of directors. And so it's really exciting stuff. We're just getting started with it. I have a community forum probably in July.
How much do you have to raise? What's the goal?
About $25 million.
Okay, a million here and a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. Where would this be based?
We have not picked a location yet. Mm-hmm. A lot of that will depend on the availability of funding and buildings and things like that.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Tom, a therapist from Kansas City, says one issue in the city is getting the sheriff's department to serve restraining orders. He says they don't do a good job. You know, Megan, what about all the departments that get involved in these types of situations and, you know, the breakdowns that can occur before the DA's office even gets involved?
I think our law enforcement does a stellar job of serving protective orders and working on these cases. I do a lot of the training for law enforcement on domestic violence investigation in Johnson County, so I'm involved in the training of all of these agencies, and I would say that they do an excellent job. The officers are very dedicated to stopping this problem. They recognize that more than anything, these offenders are cop killers, and these offenders become mass shooters in record numbers. So it's not just domestic violence at home. It spreads well beyond that, and they're very well aware of it, and I think they do a great job.
Are there issues with the serving of restraining orders, as Tom points out, that you're aware of?
None that I'm aware of. However, I will point out that the victim does need to know an address before the sheriff's department can serve it, and a lot of the times these guys are actively evading service, so they move over to Missouri, or they – I mean, it's easy to get to Missouri from here. So they move over to a different state, or they just, you know, couch surf, for lack of a better term, until the sheriff's office, you know, can no longer serve them or the time has passed for service.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Again, the number 816-235-2888. We're talking about domestic violence in Johnson County. L from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, this is kind of shocking stuff, but is there any comparison statistically with other comparable communities or cities nationwide that you might know the data on, and also the percentage of gun violence involved? You did mention it, but you didn't give a quantitative statement on that.
Any sense of how we compare to other communities? Either one of you have a feel for that? Statistics at the ready here.
So I can say in Kansas, I don't have like a comparable community. I'll say that. But I do know that in the state of Kansas, the whole state as a whole, our coalition, we're partners with the Kansas Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. And they are seeing the numbers rise as well with the need for services. I know that they reported a 30% increase in the number of people served all across the state of Kansas, and a 10% increase in the number of calls received across the state of Kansas.
Yeah. The question was national, though.
Yeah.
It was a national question. Yeah.
I'm not sure we have the answers right at the tips of our fingertips here, Al. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before I forget to ask this, you know, what should someone do if they suspect a child or an adult they know may be the victim of abuse? What would you recommend, Megan?
I think you need to talk to that person. It very much depends on the actual, on the situation itself. And I would be, in my position, me personally, my preference would be call the police, especially if you see warning signs like purchase of a gun or recent separation, things like that. I would call the police. But I would also talk to my friend first, because there might be reasons why they're not reporting it to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I think somewhat in answer to that caller's question, I don't think necessarily the numbers of domestic violence incidents themselves are going up. I think they're just getting reported more, which is a good thing.
I was wondering about that. Yeah. People are more aware and that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm wondering, Desiree, what would you add to this notion of what someone should do if they suspect a problem?
I totally agree that they need to talk to the person who is experiencing the problem, try to do the best they can to ask them in a confidential way, and then to support their decision and what they feel is best, because our survivors know their situation better than anyone else, and they know what's safest. They're really good at knowing what's safe to do and what's not safe to do and when it's safe to seek help. And so we just have to listen to our survivors and follow their lead.
To what extent does Safe Home, to what extent do the police intervene at this pivotal moment you described a few minutes ago when the decision gets made to leave? And you said that's when all heck can break loose. How should people navigate that moment?
It's so difficult. We really recommend that if they can, to call our hotline. Our hotline is confidential. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we can help them with that process. We do what's called safety planning, and we can walk them through and talk to them, find out about their situation, and figure out what's best for them.
What is that hotline number before I forget?
It's 913-262-2868.
2868.
And okay. You can access us on the web, safehome-ks.org, and on Facebook as well.
How many calls a year do you guys get?
So last year we got 5,392 calls, and that was up 15% from the year before.
5,300 calls. Mm-hmm. That's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some calls here. Heather from Kansas City, Missouri. Heather, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you. I was just going to say my spouse and I found ourselves in a situation last year where we knew someone who came to us and confided that they were in a situation that was not safe. And in struggling to try to help someone and being woefully unprepared for that, we came up against a couple obstacles, which I would like to see if your panel has some more resources for. One was her situation wasn't domestic partner abuse. It was familial abuse. So it was an older sister. She was in charge of the finances, that kind of thing. And so some shelters said that they only deal with certain types of those abusive situations. And then earlier I heard you talking about pets, and that was a huge, huge issue for this person. I mean, they would absolutely not go anywhere that wouldn't accept pets, and we were trying to find fosters for pets. But for her, it was this pet was her safety mechanism too. Like she felt like the dog would protect her, or at least growl or call attention, or, you know, when things were going bad. And then when it was over, she had, you know, a solace in that dog. And so, like, to separate them just seemed unconscionable to her.
Yeah. What about this idea of familial abuse? How common is that, Desiree?
Yeah. I mean, it is common. And the caller is right that some agencies only deal with intimate partner violence. Safe Home will take people that experiencing all types of domestic violence, including familial abuse. And I also would just tell the caller, I totally hear what she's saying about the pets and how there is that close bond. I will say that some agencies in our area that we also work closely with, like Rosebrooks or Hope Haven, they're also domestic violence agencies that do take pets. And again, we are really working hard with this other with this animal hospital, that they really do help us with the pets.
Right. You know, maybe an odd question, Megan. I'm wondering, has domestic violence changed over the years? I mean, is it different somehow today from 30 years ago because we have advanced electronics and social media and all these things? Is it a different game today?
I would say what motivates domestic violence is exactly the same as it's always been: power and control. Now, the tools for that have gotten better for the abuser over the years, because you've got more ability to electronically stalk and follow your partner. So that sort of thing is changed, and it's dynamic, and the laws have to change to reflect that sort of behavior. However, I would say the basic motivators are exactly the same. The abuse that we see, I've been doing this for close to 20 years, and the abuse that we see, the types of abuse and the reasons for it are pretty much standard and the same.
What's behind that, this idea of power and control? Why does someone become so fixated on that?
That's an excellent question. There's a lot of studies right now, and I work with a member of the Attorney General's office on a presentation about the psychology of batterer motivation, because there's different psychological profiles of batterers, if you will, and it's a much longer conversation than we have time for today. But the driving factors for the most violent types of offenders usually come from an abusive father, a fractured sense of self. They legitimately feel that they need their partner there to have control over in order to survive. And therefore, when law enforcement intervenes or when the victim leaves, that becomes a loss of that control, which usually results in the worst types of violence that we see, the murder suicides or just the homicides.
Is it possible to fix that when someone feels that way?
That's an open question. I think there's a lot of good studies and research that show that batterer's intervention programs can work in the right circumstances if you catch it early enough. On the other hand, I think once, and this is my personal opinion, once abusers start strangling their victims in non-fatal strangulation events, I think that they're probably pretty far gone at that point. That's lethal force that they're using.
Desiree, if you would give out your phone number again, just so people have it.
Yeah, it's 913-262-2868.
And that's for Safe Home, based in Overland Park. Do you have other branches across the county, or is it just one place?
It's just us in Overland Park.
In Overland Park, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Desiree Long again with Safe Home. Megan Austin's senior Johnson County assistant DA. She works in the domestic violence unit. Thank you both very much. Appreciate the information.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some fun stuff that has to do with science. And yes, science can be fun sometimes. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, more Kansans are foregoing a college diploma. We learned about the future of higher education there and how the state can meet modern workforce demands. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we go back in time 50 years when The Wild Bunch, possibly the most violent film ever up to that point, was previewed in Kansas City. Soon, the classic Western that scandalized moviegoers will return to the big screen. Hear about that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it would be an understatement to say that Marcus Chown is passionate about science. Once a radio astronomer at the California Institute of Technology, he's now a science writer of award-winning books who explains the complexities of the universe in terms even I can understand. Chown's latest is Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. He joins me now via Skype from his home in London. I guess I should be saying good evening, Marcus, and welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Well, your enthusiasm for science knows no bounds here. How disappointed are you that more humans walking the Earth aren't in constant amazement over something like the force of gravity, which you have called the weakest and the strongest force?
Well, I actually do find that people are interested, really. I mean, sometimes they've been switched off science by their school teaching. But when you talk to people about science and you tell them that it's about origins, you know, where the universe came from, where the Earth came from, where we come from, they most people are still interested. So I actually do think that most people have a real interest, but they've probably been switched off by conventional teaching.
You know, you have some great memories of your dad and how he helped spur your interest in science, especially when it comes to outer space. Tell us about that.
Well, my mum and dad grew up in London during the Blitz, during the Second World War. Sure. So their schooling was completely broken. My mum was bombed out when she was six. So they both left school when they were 15. They didn't have any qualifications. But for some reason, my dad bought me a book on astronomy when I was about eight. I've got absolutely no idea why. And because he's dead now, I can't ask him. But it kind of switched on an interest with me. And then he got me up, I'm giving away my age now, to see the moon landings, those fuzzy pictures on TV in 1969, sure. 50 years ago.
Sure.
And I mean, even talking to you about that now, it sends a shiver down my spine. You know, I was alive to see a human being step on another world, you know, which is fantastic. So those kind of things really switched me on to science, more so than what I was learning at school, which I found rather dull.
Well, given that, how excited were you when that photo of a black hole showed up a few weeks back?
I was actually very, very excited.
I bet.
Because when I was at Caltech, what I did was very long baseline interferometry, which is where you connect radio dishes in the States, in Europe, in Australia, all together. You know, you fly the recordings together, you combine them on a supercomputer, and you get an image effectively that you would have got if you had a telescope the size of the Earth. So that's what I actually did all those years ago at Caltech. So this is the technique they were using to image a black hole. I mean, a lot of people were very underwhelmed by it. They thought, well, my God, it just looks like a halo around the black disk. But of course, no one had ever seen a black hole before. I mean, we've seen them in science fiction films and things like that. And the depiction in science fiction films turns out to have been quite accurate.
I was going to say, there was a pretty good connection there, wasn't there?
Yeah, so people think, well, I've seen that before. You know, what's unusual about that? And in a way, the scientists were kind of victims of their own success, because Einstein's theory of gravity describes to us what a black hole should look like so very well. But within that halo that you saw around the black hole literally is the end of space and time. So how incredible is that? You know, we have a 3-pound brain, you know, we arose on an African plain millions of years ago, and we've actually seen to the edge of space and time. So when you see that halo of light, that light is literally flowing over into the center of the black hole like water over a waterfall, and it never ever appears in our universe again. So I think that the image itself doesn't look very exciting, but when you know what it means, it is very exciting.
So you were excited about the photo of a black hole. How did that compare to when we came across that recording of gravitational waves back in 2015?
I don't want to be thought of as someone who gets excited about everything, but that really was incredibly exciting. And, you know, gravitational waves are ripples in the very fabric of space-time, you know, and they were predicted by Einstein about 100 years ago at the height of the First World War, 1915. And they are literally sound waves. So we, you know, for all of history, we've been able to see the universe with our eyes and with our telescopes. And so on the 14th of September, 2015, that's the date, yep, we were able to hear the universe for the very first time. So, and the event that we heard was two black holes which were spiraling into each other, and they merged. And in that instant, they generated 50 times more power than is emitted by all the stars in the universe together. So that's the single most powerful event ever witnessed by human beings. I mean, to put it another way, if it hadn't emitted these gravitational waves, kind of a tsunami of tortured space-time, if it actually created visible light instead, that single event would have shone 50 times brighter than the entire universe. So that's pretty phenomenal. And I think many discoveries in science, you know, it's just a one-off discovery. This is actually the creation of an entire new science. So we've got this sense of hearing, and it's only the beginning. We don't know what we're going to hear out there in the universe. So that's what makes it exciting.
In really simple terms, what causes gravitational waves? Do you have any sense for that, Marcus?
Well, it's difficult to know. I mean, basically, Newton, in the 17th century, he imagined that gravity was like an invisible tether, you know, connecting the Earth to the Sun and keeping the Earth trapped orbiting the Sun. But Einstein in 1915 realized that that was incorrect. And what the Sun actually does is it actually warps the space-time around it. It creates a valley in the space-time. We can't actually see it because it's a four-dimensional thing and we're only three-dimensional beings, but it creates a valley. So you can imagine the Earth then orbits around the upper reaches of this valley, rather like a roulette ball in a roulette wheel. So space itself is a thing. Okay, so it's a thing that can be bent into a valley, it can be warped. And the ultimate expression of that is a gravitational wave, because not only can you bend space into a valley, and in the case of a black hole, a bottomless pit out of which nothing can escape, you can actually ripple it, so you can actually wobble it. And that's actually what happened with the merger of these two black holes. Space-time itself was like wobbled. If you imagine it like a rubber sheet or whatever that you wobbled, then these waves of space-time came out. So it's the ultimate proof that space-time is actually a thing. Space is a thing. You wouldn't think of it, would it? But I want to tell you that it's an incredibly stiff thing. Now, it's easy to vibrate, for instance, the you know, drum skin. That's because the drum skin is quite flexible. But it turns out that space-time is a billion, billion, billion times stiffer than steel. So you can imagine how difficult it is to vibrate it. This is why only these incredibly violent events make appreciable gravitational waves. I mean, if you wave your hand in the air now, you're creating gravitational waves. But they are so minuscule that they're pretty much undetectable. And the only things that we've managed to detect are these most violent objects in the universe that really, really vibrate and oscillate space-time.
You know, for all the technology that's been used to observe space, you've said that we've only seen 5% of it. Is that really right? I mean, 5%, I can't imagine.
Absolutely incredible, isn't it, really? In fact, we've only seen 2.5%. Only 5% of the universe is made of atoms. So that's the stuff that you and me are made of, that the stars are made of, that the galaxies are made of, all the stuff we see with our telescopes made of atoms, only 5%. And only half of that have we actually seen. We kind of suspect that the other half is in the form of maybe very cold gas or very hot gas that doesn't give out any light, perhaps between the galaxies. So we've only seen half of that. But the other 95% turns out to be made of two things. You've probably heard of them. One of them is dark matter. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the matter that we're made of is outweighed by a factor of 6 by dark material in the universe. We can see its effect. So its gravity tugs on the visible stuff, so we can actually see it's pulling on the visible stuff. We've got absolutely no idea what it is. I mean, there have been experiments all over the world for the last 20, 30 years trying to find out what it is. Obviously, there's a Nobel Prize for anyone who can find out what it is, but no one's managed to do it. But in addition to that, that counts for maybe about 23% of the mass of the universe. About 73%, so 74%, is the stuff called dark energy. And this was only discovered in 1998. And it's invisible. It fills all of space. And it's got repulsive gravity. Hmm. And its repulsive gravity is speeding up the expansion of the universe. So we've got, and if we're at sea, not knowing what dark matter is, we've got no idea what dark energy is either. Mm-hmm. So I would say this is an incredibly exciting point in the history of science. I mean, to suddenly realize that we've only been, what science has been studying these last 350 years is only 5% of what there is, and we don't know what the 95% is a really incredible place to be. Yeah. Quite exciting. And no one, I mean, if you take gravitational waves, 100 years it took to detect them. I mean, I would have said we might not have detected them for another 10, 20 years. But dark matter and dark energy, we're probably going to find out what they are in the next 10 to 20 years. And No one really has a clue.
Marcus Chown is my guest. His latest book, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. You know, we're sitting here talking about science, but I want to give our listeners a sense of how much you pack into less than 200 pages in this book. For instance, you write about the fact that people age faster on the top floor of a building than on the ground floor. Help me understand that.
Well, we've just been talking about Einstein's theory of gravity, you know, which predicted the existence of gravitational waves. But basically what it actually says is that time flows more slowly in strong gravity. Now, that's incredible. You probably think, you know, all clocks run at exactly the same rate, you know, my clock, your clock, but that isn't true. It's a fantastically small effect. But so if you were to be on the top floor of a building, you would be further away from the mass of the Earth, so gravity would be slightly weaker, so time would flow more slowly for you on the top floor compared to the ground floor. And incredibly,
but it's not noticeable, though, is it?
Well, I'll get on to that. In about 2010, I think physicists in Colorado were able to show that if you stood on one step of a staircase and someone stood on the step below you, your time flowed more quickly than theirs. And they did it with two super accurate atomic clocks. So you might, yeah, it's a very small effect. Unless gravity is very strong, for instance, near a black hole, it's not very appreciable. But this effect affects your life, your daily life. Because if you've got a sat nav or a mobile phone that has can locate your position, it locates your position on the Earth's surface relative to global positioning satellites. And there's a constellation of these, and they have highly elongated orbits. So they come in close to the Earth and they go far out, and they carry onboard clocks. And when those satellites come in close to the Earth or in strong gravity, their clocks slow down. And when they go further out, they speed up. And the software in your sat nav, in your phone, has to compensate for that effect. Because if it didn't, you'd get your location wrong by about 50 meters, an extra 50 meters every day. So actually, these incredible things that, you're absolutely right, tiny, tiny effect, but they actually do affect our daily lives.
Marcus Chown is my guest. Again, the title of your book is Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand. How can we hold infinity in the palm of our hands?
Well, of course you can't.
I hope not.
This is a line of poetry by William Blake.
Yes.
If I can actually find it.
To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
Beautiful piece of poetry. But basically, my book is 50 bonkers things, 50 wild things about the universe. I mean, I'm amazed that we live in this universe. It's far more ridiculous than anything we could possibly have invented. So I thought I would just pick out 50 things that I think illustrate that, and that's what I did in my book.
While most of us think of helium as the gas that makes balloons float and our voices sound like Mickey Mouse, you call it the loopy liquid that can do some remarkable stuff. Tell us about liquid helium.
Well, I'll tell you about helium, first of all, because I'm talking to you from the place where it was discovered. It was actually discovered from a back garden in Wimbledon in London in the 1860s. So Wimbledon, where they have the one of the Grand Slam tennis tournaments, that's where it was found. And it's the only element that was discovered on the sun before it was discovered on the Earth. So it was discovered during a total eclipse of the sun. But it's actually the only substance that never becomes solid. So it doesn't matter how cold you make it; it never actually freezes. But the liquid, as you were saying, has these weird properties, like it can actually run uphill. Did you know that?
No.
Very difficult to spot because it's actually a see-through liquid. But if you put it in a beaker, it will run up the sides and over the edges. And this is because it's what's called a quantum liquid. And I'm not sure that I have the time to explain how that works, but it has some really amazingly counterintuitive properties. And it accounts for 10% of the atoms in the whole universe. Huh. About 90% are hydrogen and about 10% are helium. So all those things you learn about when you're at school, you know, the periodic table, all those elements, calcium, you know, iron, oxygen, carbon, they only count for less than 2% of the universe. So most of the universe is hydrogen and helium.
Huh. Marcus Chown is my guest. He's an author. His new book, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand. Let's go to Don from Kansas City, Kansas. Don, good morning.
Hi, I'm really enjoying the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of my undergraduate degrees is in physics, and I try to keep up. But this last thing with Legos and the laser measurement of gravitational waves has left me a little bit confused, and I'm hoping the professor can help straighten me out. My understanding of gravity is that it is a distortion of space-time that creates a gravity well that pulls objects towards one another as if they're going from a higher energy state to a lower one. What I don't understand is when these objects are exploding like neutron stars fusing and sending out these waves, I see that as energy propagation through space-time the same way that energy propagates through water. It's not the water that's moving, it's the energy. And energy that propagates like through water actually either lifts you up or pushes you away from the object sending out the energy propagation. I'm not sure how you're calling this gravitational waves. Plus, if every object puts out gravitational waves, why do we need a 17-kilometer or 12-mile, I'm not sure exactly the length, measurement for it? We should be able to measure very small gravitational distortions.
Don, you're going to lose me. You're getting deep in the weeds here. Okay. Marcus, help me. Help our listeners here a little bit.
Okay. Well, as I was saying earlier, because space-time is effectively so amazingly stiff, a billion, billion, billion times stiffer than steel, it's very, very difficult to vibrate. And so although in principle the acceleration of any mass, including you waving your hand, creates gravitational waves, those are very, very much too small for us to actually detect. And incredibly, we can only detect the gravitational waves from these violent events. And we need effectively a ruler. And that's what the two LIGO detectors, one of them's in Louisiana and the other one's in Washington State. And they're 4-kilometer rulers made of laser light. And the idea is as a gravitational wave goes past these rulers, it alternately stretches and squeezes them, but by a fantastically small amount. It's something like a billionth, I can't actually remember the details now, but a billionth the diameter of a single atom, something like that. So incredibly, they can measure this fantastically small stretching and squeezing of a 4-kilometer long ruler. I mean, it's phenomenal. And it's the reason that the three of the people who worked on this project won the 2017 Nobel Prize for Physics.
You know, at Caltech, when you were there, you were in the presence of Nobel laureates and others who shared that excitement for science. I just can't help but wonder, do you miss that community?
I do a bit. I'm really a journalist and a writer, and I have a butterfly mind, so I'm kind of interested in lots of things. And one of the problems is when you do research, you do become focused in on a smaller and smaller area. So I did what's called very long baseline interferometry. We were looking at the center of quasars, which are basically violent galaxies that contain supermassive black holes. And a typical graduate student would spend 10 years or actually making a map of a single one of these objects to try and discover something. So you really are focused in on a very tiny field. But I was incredibly lucky when I was at Caltech because I was taught by Richard Feynman, who was one of the greatest post-war physicists, and was very famous for his personality and his bongo playing as much as he was for winning the Nobel Prize in Physics. So that was a really a massive treat to to be. Yeah, yeah, I miss it a bit, but actually, I've never looked back. Actually, I when I was at school, I really liked physics, but I also liked writing. And in England, I don't know what it's like in America, it wasn't possible to study both art subjects and science subjects at the same time. So I had to go for physics. But I've always liked writing. I used to write short stories and things. So I kind of combined my two interests to earn a living.
You know, you have some great quotes in here under the chapter headings of infinity, like this one from Gary Larson's The Far Side, that it shows these dinosaurs talking and saying this to each other. You know, the picture is pretty bleak, gentlemen. The world's climates are changing. The mammals are taking over. And we all have a brain about the size of a walnut. And then you proceed to describe what the juvenile sea squirt does with its brain. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I try and use something to start off that catches people's interest, but then try and explain or describe something profound. But the juvenile sea squirt, it swims through the sea looking for a rock to cling to, you know, to make its home. And when it actually finds a rock and it clamps onto that rock, it no longer needs its brain. So it eats it. It eats it. And what I'm illustrating here is that actually brains are incredibly energy hungry. I mean, for instance, your brain uses about 20% of the energy of your body, but it's only about 3% of your mass. So it's using about 10 times as much energy pound for pound as any other part of your body. And because brains are so energy hungry, you know, most organisms on Earth do not have brains. And a juvenile sea squirt, once it's actually located, it's done its navigation, located its home, it no longer eats its brain, so it eats it. So this is really what I'm talking about. I mean, the brain is an incredible thing. It works on the energy, the power of a dim light bulb, but it's a supercomputer that was equivalent to the brain would use, you know, dozens and dozens of kilowatts, but your brain works on the power of a dim light bulb.
You know, how surprising is it to you after watching this for so many years, Marcus, that, you know, that some theories take hundreds of years to prove? What do you make of that?
Which ones are you thinking of?
Well, nothing comes to mind, but just in general, these things, you know, it takes so long for these things to come into modern understanding.
Well, I mean, an interesting thing that I've written about Peter Higgs, who is a Scottish physicist who predicted a Higgs particle. That was discovered in 2012 at the Large Hadron Collider, which is a giant particle accelerator on the Swiss-French border. And he predicted its existence in 1965. And it took 40 odd years, and €5 billion, which is probably about $5 billion, and there it was. I mean, but I actually personally, I find this unbelievable. You know, how is it that someone can scrawl, you know, arcane formulae on a whiteboard, a blackboard, on a piece of paper, and then people go and look, and this thing turns out to actually exist in the real world?
Well, it's like you've mentioned Newton in our conversation. You've mentioned Einstein. Sort of the same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, how incredible is that? I mean, this all begins, I believe, with Urban Le Verrier, and he predicted the existence of Neptune because the planet Uranus, or Uranus, however you pronounce it, was discovered in the 1780s in England, and pretty soon it was discovered that it wasn't moving in the way it should. Mm-hmm. Something was tugging on it, and from that he was able to deduce the existence of an unknown planet, which was then discovered. Neptune, he said, well, if you look in this particular constellation, you'll find it. And since then...
I got about 10 seconds, Marcus.
Okay, but since then, you know, we've predicted gravitational waves, black holes. These have all been predicted on pieces of paper, but then they turn out to exist in the real universe.
Yeah, it's
universe,
incredible.
Which
just
is incredible.
Amazing, yes. Well, Marcus Chown's latest book, Infinity in the Palm of Your Hand, 50 Wonders That Reveal an Extraordinary Universe. Marcus, I love your energy. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow, it's been 50 years since the Wild Bunch scandalized Kansas City, leaving some viewers literally running out of the theater. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how that film became a Western classic. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.